was even in favor of maintaining the presence of ROTC on campus, not to give ROTC academic credit, but to allow it to remain as an option for anyone seeking the military life or needing it to complete an education. What a professor had said to the faculty about ROTC being useless was nonsense to me. In a worthwhile war, who would not wish to be led by a more thoughtful and educated first lieutenant? That's the comment of an English instructor who was at Harvard during the tumultuous times in the late 1960s when ROTC had been voted off the campus. What is the appropriate role or presence for the military and for military-related studies in American higher education? I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
The Reserve Officer Training Corps, or ROTC, has returned to places like Harvard, Yale, Columbia, and Stanford after being banned for more than 40 years. What was the relationship between the military and the university prior to and during the Vietnam War? How has the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell changed universities' opposition to military presence on campus? What are the pros and cons for having more interchange between civilians and members of the military on college campuses? Joining us to discuss arms and the university is Donald Downs, professor of political science, law, and journalism at the UW-Madison, and co-author of Arms and the University, Military Presence and the Civic Education of Non-Military Students, just released by Cambridge University Press.
And welcome back to University of the Air.
Oh, thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, as a, I've used the word in quotation marks, veteran of Air Force ROTC, in a university setting where it was required because the university was a land-grant institution, I still have mixed thoughts about whether that was a positive experience or useful experience for me or my country or not. I go back and forth about that. But the interesting thing was that it was ROTC was compulsory at the University of Florida for my first year there, and then it was rendered voluntary, at which point I guess about half or more of the students, including yours truly, dropped out. So what was the whole relationship between land-grant institutions and compulsory ROTC?
Right. Well, the Morrill Act in 1862, which established, you know, the land-grant system for federal funding and land for public universities, had a clause in it that required the universities that took participated in that program had to have military training. That's all it said. So it didn't specify ROTC. ROTC didn't exist until 1916, but universities did have to set up some sort of program for it. The nature of those programs varied widely. The model was probably the private universities that had military training, like Norwich University in Virginia, the Citadel, a handful of places like that. That was sort of the model, but the law did not specify that that model be followed. So programs varied all over the country. It wasn't until 1916 that ROTC was established as the official way of doing that in the defense spending bill of that year. And ironically, ROTC did not do anything during World War I, which started right after 1916 for the United States, because it hadn't been up and going yet. They had to train people to be officers very quickly. So basically, the military took over that kind of instruction directly and had major roles on campus, such as the University of Wisconsin. So it wasn't until after World War I that ROTC really started gearing up as a program.
You said it was the Morrill Act of 1863. Morrill, and in terms of that, it was your moral duty?
No. It was a congressman named Morrill. Last name was Morrill.
All right.
It's a Morrill Land Grant Act. And interestingly, you know, we have a statue of Abraham Lincoln at the top of Bascom Hill. And one reason I'm told for that statue being there is because of Lincoln's signing the Morrill Act, which was a major event in the history of the University of Wisconsin, as well as other major public universities.
Was there ever any kind of opposition early on to universities having ROTC? Was there any, like, faculty or administrators who raised questions
about it?
Right,
and you're talking about with ROTC and after 1916?
Yeah.
Generally speaking, nothing major, but there were movements. For example, one led by John Dewey, the famous philosopher, which were concerned about militarization on campus. And so periodically there have been pockets of resistance because of that. And it's a motive that I actually, you know, I identify with. One reason I think ROTC is a good idea is that it can prevent militarization because it exposes military and non-military people to each other
right.
in a way which I think can give a more realistic understanding of one another. And also ROTC is seen as a vehicle for exercising more civilian control over the military. But yes, there was. And I think it makes some sense because universities and the military are distinctly different institutions. As you know from your 1 year, Norman, the military is based more on the notion of command.
Yes.
And following orders. It's much more disciplined. And anyone who's ever been to an average college campus knows that that's not necessarily the way things always work on campus.
Well, yeah, that's true. I mean, the ROTC that I took had two components, probably pretty typical. One was the drill where you're out on the
right.
field in uniform, you know, marching around. And then the other was the classroom where you would learn about military
right.
tactics and weaponry,
right.
that kind of thing. But in neither case do I remember much room for the kind of questioning that one is
right.
encouraged to engage in at most universities.
Right, right. And coming off of that, too, the quality of many ROTC courses was not really that academically rigorous.
Right.
So there were concerns about that. Yale had a major concern about that, for example. But in general, most presidents and leaders of universities thought it was a good thing to participate in these programs because they believed in sort of commonly sharing the burden of national defense, and they felt a kind of civic commitment. Student opposition varied depending on the situation. In the sort of anti-war movements before World War I, before World War II, there was some student opposition to these kinds of things. But then once the war efforts geared up, and you know, World War I and World War II were total wars where there was a major national commitment, that opposition tended to wane. But generally speaking, the leaders of universities were in favor of this. Interestingly, after 1916, several student groups and leaders of major universities said, we want a part of this action too, including the Ivy League. The Ivy League didn't want to be left out of this, and partly because, you know, there's some money there. Eventually, there became scholarship money available there. But also, they saw it as a matter of prestige for the university to be involved in this kind of civic duty.
Now, if you followed ROTC through its full trajectory, what would be the end course of it? I mean, it's not the same as going to West Point or Annapolis in terms of giving you a leg up in your military career. How did it actually work?
Right. Well, you'd get commissioned coming out of school, and then you would go to your, you know, to the Army, Navy, Air Force, which came up later, and you would get further training at that point. And then after you got further training for several months, then you would join the service itself. So it was kind of a stepping stone, but an important one.
Your book talks about attitudes toward war in general and how that also influences the way the presence of mm-hmm. military on a campus, you know, came about. And you even include part of Lincoln's Gettysburg Address as an example of something where it's, you know, given on a battlefield
right.
and, you know, speaking very directly about the military. But if you look back at this gulf that has come to be between the military and the civilians, where do you start tracing some of that chasm?
Right, right. Well, that was one of the occasions for writing the book in the first place, is a more recent concern, especially after the rise of the all-volunteer force in 1973. Right now, less than 1% of our population is bearing the real burden of dealing with our wars and fighting our wars. And there has been more of a separation that's grown between the military as an institution and the rest of us. And that's manifested in many different levels, including at universities. But it's a gap that's always been there to some extent, and I think it's a healthy thing to have it to some extent. There's always been a suspicion in America about a standing military. There's a big issue when the arguments over the Constitution, when we adopted the Constitution and went through ratification back in the 18th century, a concern, would this establish the basis for having a permanent standing military that could therefore, you know, threaten our
right.
freedoms and just our private lives? So a certain tension between the military and civil society, I think, is good. The question, though, is if it becomes too much of an alienation, too much of a gap, do we then create a situation where the military is not going to be responsive enough to civil society? And you get policy questions where the military might exert undue influence. And you might get situations where, you know, military would end up having too heavy of a hand because it's not connected with the civil society as much. Those are the major concerns that among the major concerns that have arisen. So you don't want the gap to be too big, but you also want some sort of gap, because you don't want a society that's dictated by the military, and you want a society that avoids militarism. You know, militarism is an ideology that, you know, war is good because it builds character, et cetera. I mean, there are some virtues in war, sure, like with anything, but, you know, it certainly has a lot of negativity
and a lot of costs.
Well. Mm-hmm. Well, huge costs, and both, you know, financial and, of course, human. So you want there to be an appropriate kind of relationship, which I think is a combination of tension, but also due mutual respect. Another aspect, I think, of an undue gap is an undue disdain for the military and sort of a decline of a sense of wanting to participate in it, if necessary, and a lack of appreciation for what the military does. So an undue gap can lead to militarization on one hand, or it can also lead to, I think, an irresponsible underappreciation of the military. You want the proper kind of balance.
What about the issue of being on a college campus where you have young, vulnerable adults? I'm thinking, you know, I have a nephew who's 18 and just joined the Marines, so I'm aware of how young he is for someone who might be sent to Afghanistan. But let's say you go to a college campus where you have young adults that have just been sent away from home for the first time in some cases, very impressionable, very vulnerable, sometimes economically strapped.
Right.
To have the presence of military recruiters who are looking basically for bodies to get on board and to, you know, get them sent in sort of directions that would lead them into combat in some cases. Is there sort of an ethical problem of almost taking advantage of the presence of so many young, vulnerable people?
Well, I think if you cross a line with that, certainly there would be. For the most part, I want to see the students that are in it get into it before they come to the campus and get accepted by the program. There is, at least to my knowledge, in more recent times, not aggressive recruiting on campus going on, partly because they're sensitive to these problems. It's probably more of a problem when it comes to high schools. And that has been an issue. I know at Madison East, there was a parental movement you probably heard about that wanted to keep the military out of there. On the other hand, you have recruiting for all sorts of other things on campus. You know, companies come in here, political organizations come in here. I think it's appropriate to let the military have its equal voice in that.
As long as they're playing by the same rules as the other recruiters.
Right, as long as they're playing by the same rules and as long as they're sensitive to the problems that Emily has brought up.
Isn't it different, though, because doesn't the ROTC on a campus then sort of almost take on doesn't it come under the umbrella of the university in a way that a company would not?
Right, and also its presence on campus creates an issue for university control as well, because the military picks the instructors. Universities can veto them. That's been a concern all along since 1916 with ROTC, that there's less institutional autonomy or control when it comes to those institutions, which is one reason that ROTC was moved out of the Ivy League in the 1960s because of concerns about institutional accountability. That's been rectified to a significant extent. There's much more university input in terms of instructors now, in terms of course content and things like that. But getting back to the original question, that indeed can be an issue and it has to be dealt with.
What about the Cold War? What happened in terms of the military presence on campuses during the Cold War?
Yeah. Well, World War II, there are two back-to-back universities, I call them. One is the World War II University. The second is the Cold War University. And the World War II University was really an almost unprecedented phenomenon because universities were taken over almost wholesale by the military in the name of sort of national security emergency necessity in a total war. And there was relatively little controversy about that. I mean, first of all, the war itself was conceded to be a necessary war, though we sometimes idealize it too much. And you look at the lead up to World War II, there was more controversy and dissent than we often acknowledge in retrospect. But once the war got going, you know, the enemy was pretty clear. Hitler was a very evil person, really posed a threat to Europe and perhaps to us down the line. So there was a great deal of consensus behind the war. And that led people to be less critical about what was close to an invasion of the military on campus for military training purposes. And also there was a time where academic departments became much more involved in doing research for the war effort. It's the first time that you had chemistry departments, engineering departments, physics departments actually doing very specifically applied military kinds of research. And, of course, that's very controversial, but it was basically a national necessity kind of situation, so people accepted that. And then after World War II, America confronted an unprecedented kind of situation. We were now the leader of the free world. We had our economy was humming once again. Our allies needed us. We were going to buy our products. We were on top of the world, so to speak, economically. And we maintained a strong posture between the university and the military because of the Cold War that emerged pretty soon after World War II. And for a while, that there wasn't a whole lot of controversy about that either, because we were still sort of committed. It was a cold, what's called the Cold War consensus from 1945 through the later 50s. And we had, you know, Korea, even though that was a problematic military endeavor, there was still basic national consensus behind it. Though the fact that it ended up leading to a truce, you couldn't call that a total victory, that led to some people kind of questioning it. And also, as time went on in the 50s, you had McCarthyism, I think, discredited the government and national security to some extent among a lot of people, including academic people. So the seeds were sort of planted for concerns about maintaining such a powerful relationship between the national government and the university in terms of funding, and especially in the military kind of context. And then, of course, you had the run-up to Vietnam, where those seeds really started to sprout.
Difference between voluntary and compulsory ROTC, though, where does that sort out?
Yeah, that's a very important point. And I noticed you said that you had it for 1 year, Norman. Wisconsin was the first institution nationwide to do away with compulsory ROTC. And there was some concern at the time that are we allowed to do this under the terms of the contracts with the government. And the government backed off and allowed it.
What date was that?
It was in the 1930s, I think it was. It was early.
In Wisconsin, really?
Yeah.
Because it wasn't full.
Yeah, I have to go back and look at my book. I don't remember the date exactly, but it was well before.
I thought you were talking about the 1960s or something, but you're talking about back then. And then what was the argument then? The academic freedom? Or?
Yeah, and it was the progressive movement in Wisconsin had an influence over that as well.
Mm-hmm.
I read some material from the Cap Times back then criticizing having that kind of compulsory. That was an example of the military having too much influence over universities as civil institutions. But I forgot the exact date on that. I have to go check that.
And did other universities follow suit?
Yeah, it eventually became the norm.
We're going to follow the presence of the military into the Vietnam era when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. Stupidly, we thought revolution was imminent. Our rage blinded us. I now believe that the war in Vietnam drove us crazy. That's a comment of Mark Rudd, former leader of Students for a Democratic Society, Columbia University, speaking at the university's 20th anniversary of the 1968 crisis. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Donald Downs, and we're talking about arms in the university. That quote comes from the chapter in your book that you call ROTC and the Ivies, The Divorce.
Right.
Looking at the sort of dissolution of the relationship between the military and the university. Can you talk about how Vietnam played such a central role
in
that split?
I mean, it's a crucial thing historically. I should mention first, though, that I mentioned earlier in response to one of Norman's questions that when ROTC was first founded or established, Ivy League campuses wanted a piece of that action. And sort of showed historically, during the Civil War, for example, Harvard was famous for having a regiment that fought in the Civil War. And Oliver Wendell Holmes, a famous Supreme Court justice, was part of that. So, but things did start changing as we moved into Vietnam. And Vietnam was a turning point for our country in so many different ways, and it's still affecting our politics, as we all know. And as the war became unpopular, ROTC became – it was the most obvious or prominent symbol on campus about the war. And it was a time when people were looking for deeper causes of things and see what made America go this route. And militarization was seen as one of the reasons. And there's something to that, given this sort of the mentality of America coming out of World War II and the Cold War University. And people sort of downplayed the ways in which ROTC might actually be one method to try to alleviate or having have less militarization on campus because it exposes these officers to civilian institutions. Those kinds of aspects of ROTC were ignored and was simply seen as a sign of American militarism and imperialism around the world. And, of course, here at Wisconsin, it was said it was torched, firebombed, and it was Kent State University, 1970. It was anti-ROTC protests that were really the most important aspect of what led to those shootings in 1970. It was shortly before that they had burned the ROTC, one of the ROTC headquarters, to the ground. So people turned on ROTC because it was the most prominent symbol on campus of highly unpopular war, and
sort
understandably
of,
unpopular war.
Sort of the way an embassy gets targeted when a country is sort of – it becomes
absolutely,
the place.
Absolutely.
And that's regardless of whether at this point ROTC was compulsory or not. I mean, it was –
Yeah, that didn't – that was if it were still compulsory someplace, then that would make it even more controversial. And, of course, you know, the draft had a lot to do with this. I mean, I was in college during that time, and I ended up having a high draft number. It's just how it worked out. And the fact that the draft was there was clearly one of the factors in protest. If ROTC is going to be compulsory, that's going to compound the felony, so to speak.
So how did the military feel about it? Their presence on campus. I mean, how important did they feel that it was?
Well, first of all, they were shocked about what was happening. And one of the first major anti-ROTC protests took place at Columbia in 1965. And it was at where they're going to have one of their ceremonies for commissioning. And a variety of student groups formed a kind of coalition and protested it. And they threw pie in people's faces and things like that. And the Navy was a naval program. The Navy was shocked at what happened. And leaders of Columbia kind of reassured them, we will do what we can about this. But, of course, that was the beginning of a long movement to get it off. And they wanted to keep it because there had been historically significant ties. The Ivy League schools, Harvard, Columbia, were two of the top four federally funded higher education institutions in the country, with a lion's share of that funding involving either the military or national security kinds of things, social science programs on languages, et cetera. Those all had a kind of foreign policy aspect to them as well. And so there are huge involvements there. And Columbia had a relationship with a major military kind of think tank that actually was considered more important than their relationship with ROTC. So universities had a lot at stake, and the military had a lot at stake in that relationship. But as protests mounted and mounted, military started backing off more and more. They made concessions. The resistance to ROTC took two forms, and one had been around for a long time, as I alluded to earlier. One was academic standards. That is, between after World War II and the late 60s, universities became – American universities became even more nationally – or more internationally prominent as academic excellence and standards were increased. So you had – that was sort of on a collision course with ROTC, which really hadn't adjusted to that enough. And so a lot of the protests, a lot of the criticism within the university, especially among faculty and administrators, had to do with academic standards.
Out of curiosity, what are American approaches to ROTC on campuses like compared to, say, that in Europe or other places? I mean, are we pretty much the same as what's done in England and France and Germany, or –
Yeah, it's a good question. I'm probably not as prepared to answer that. Canada has its own had its own form of ROTC. It's Canadian COTC, Canadian Officer Training Corps, that they got rid of also around the same time. And but that was engineered by the government. It was not engineered by political movements like it was on this campus. It was more of a centralized thing. ROTC presence on campus was usually, they did have their national headquarters. Later on in the 1980s, they had a cadet commands that took over to make it even more centralized. But in terms of programs, it was pretty much university by university, conforming to rather broad national standards. In Canada, it was all run from the top down, and the government said, we don't consider this to be useful anymore, and they got rid of it. England had a similar kind of program. I don't know all the specifics of it and how it differed. But fundamentally, I think it was pretty much the same.
What was the effect, or was there a palpable effect on the military of this disengagement with the college campuses that we see as we get into the Vietnam War?
Right. Well, there were, as we get away from the Vietnam War.
I imagine it would take it a while to sink in anyway, but in that period of the 60s going into the 70s.
Right. Well, it lost membership or lost representation in six of the Ivy League schools. Princeton got rid of it, but then it came back 2 years later. That was very
odd. Just 2 years later.
Most people don't realize that, but it came back as a non-credit kind of program and in the Army, just one of the units. Well, it was sort of the beginning of the more contemporary divorce, so to speak. And on one hand, that meant that some campuses just got rid of it. It lost representation there. And ROTC became marginalized in many other kind of places. And even at Wisconsin, you know, we have over 200 cadets, I think, right now, at least when I was doing the book we did. Small number given the number of people on campus, but it's still a fair number. But it's been up and down in terms of membership over the years. A lot of factors will go into the question of recruiting. But it was the beginning of that kind of divide. Also a divide between the elites of this country and the military. And I think that's a key aspect that I get at in the book. If you are middle class, upper middle class, upper class, it's highly unusual for you to have a family member that goes into the military. And I've read accounts of family of why someone's son would go into the Marines, and all their friends would say, why would he want to do that?
Right.
Like, it's a crazy thing to do. And so people that are benefiting the most from our society are not connected to them. It's an alien kind of institution to them in many ways. Let them go off and do the dirty work for the country. We don't want to have anything to do with that. And also there was a beginning of a kind of a geographic and cultural split that the military, partly in reaction to this, said, well, we don't need you. And we don't need the Ivy League. We're not going to worry about maybe some of the major state universities like Wisconsin and Michigan, though those have always been involved with the program up to now. We're going to shift our attention to those areas of the country where we're going to get people that are more culturally in sync with the military.
Does that mean economically strapped?
There's a big debate about that. It could to some extent. But they're looking more at cultural values. So there's been a movement, and this sort of also follows the changes in the locations of some military bases. And Tom Ricks has written about this. More to the south. ROTC representation in the south is much greater qua the population than it is in the northeast and in the major cities on the west coast. And so, parts of the Midwest, the South, and parts of the Southwest is where you get most of the ROTC kind of units that are grossly disproportionate in terms of population. New York City has three ROTC schools that host ROTC programs for all the different colleges around there, and it's got a population of over 10 million people. So partly that was because institutions, colleges in those areas were less interested in ROTC. The populations were less interested in the military, but also because the military itself said, we want to go to these other areas. So it's been a two-way kind of street. This has been documented a lot by a woman named Cheryl Miller at the American Enterprise Institute, who has a major new report on how this has happened. And there are people I interviewed in the military that were very concerned about it as well. It's a two-way street. So it's the beginning of that kind of divide in terms of elites and the military, certain geographic areas in the military, and certain universities in the military.
Well, it's sort of intriguing, maybe irrelevant. Let's say the last president that we had who was a veteran, other than the Air National Guard, which sounds like it was maybe, yes, maybe no, but would have been Bush Sr.
Yeah, I think that's correct, yes.
And so maybe there is something to that disconnect between the college-educated and the military.
Absolutely. And you see it in Congress as well. The percentage of members of Congress that have military experience is lower than it has been at any time in the 20th century. And we have two chapters on military history as a study in relationship to these kinds of questions. And after World War II, up until probably sometime in the 1970, later 1970s and the 1980s, about one-third of the members of the UW History Department had served in the military because of World War II. And by the time Matt Kaufman, who was the last military historian before the recent hiring of John Hall there,
right,
it had gotten down to, you know, two or three members. And so it's people that just, you lose contact with the military. It sort of becomes something, two levels of problem here. One is outright hostility, which is sort of a legacy of Vietnam for some. And the other is just simply alienation. It's not part of the universe within which I exist.
Yeah, just a general lack of awareness.
Yeah, indifference. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, to some extent that's healthy because we don't want to militarize society. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, it can contribute to the kind of divorce that we've been talking about that can lead to other problems.
Well, you'd have to wonder then if, after what you've said about Congress having much lower military representation than traditionally, what kind of disconnect you get in terms of funding the military endorsing.
Well, it's interesting. If
operations.
Anything, probably leads to the maybe overfunding. I don't know. there was a study done in a book published about 10 years ago that looked at policy implications of this in Congress, and they didn't find any major difference. But Andrew Bacevich, who's a military historian, very public commentator on this, a retired major who's very critical of a lot of America's military policies, including the Iraq War. His son was killed in the Iraq War. He argues that it has actually created a more militaristic Congress because you have people that don't appreciate the costs of war. The human costs of war. And one wonders if we had, and I'm not, in the book we explicitly don't advocate bringing back a draft. I mean, first of all, I wasn't drafted and I would feel sheepish about doing that. But second of all, I don't think you should have a draft unless it's a real national necessity, say like World War II was.
Vietnam was the last draft.
Yes, absolutely. Nixon did away with it. And all the volunteer force was passed in 1973. So had you, though, had the possibility of being drafted, would we have gone into Iraq? Because you would have now, you would have had this potential reluctance of people who were going to have to put their own skins on the line if they supported that war, that might have thought twice about that and influenced politics.
Well, there's always been, if you're talking about officers, which you would be with ROTC, there's always this disconnect between the officer class and enlisted class and as to who goes and what they do if they do go.
Right. And there's a book by another retired major, I think he's retired now. He has a PhD at Columbia and it's now became a book. And it's about, he did the first systematic survey of enlisted people in the Army. And he found that their attitudes on things were not all that different from the regular population, where there's more of a difference is in the officer corps. And for various reasons that they distinguish themselves from the rest of us. Some people argue that that's overblown. I don't think it's a crisis. I think it's a problem. But the officer corps tends to be more conservative. This is up, you know, the last couple of years, things have changed a little bit, but more conservative politically, more religious than others, and coming more from areas of the country that are not representative of the country as a whole. So there's that distinction. And, you know, one of the original arguments for ROTC was that the military leaders and the civilian leaders behind the 1916 Act didn't want the military academies to be the places where all the officers were produced because they thought that was an unhealthy situation on a variety of levels.
What do you think the legacy then would be in terms of all those movements that took place during the Vietnam War? The you know, ROTC out, the things that were happening right here in Madison, for instance, what was the lasting effect of all that?
Well, the lasting effect, I think, was the kind of alienation and gap that we've been talking about and, you know, that kind of tension.
The distrust.
Distrust. Sort of mutual distrust. We did a survey of a few hundred Wisconsin, UW-Madison poli-sci students and asked them about what exposure ROTC did for them. And a few of them were critical, which is fine. I mean, we want some criticism. And others said that exposure humanized the military in a way that they thought was productive. It made them think more about what the military does. It corrected some of their misinformation about the military. And it made them think about, maybe these people are citizens as well. They're not just the other, so to speak. And we found that that kind of existential connection was the most important thing about their presence on campus. But the legacy of Vietnam was to create that kind of indifference. And, you know, maybe we didn't do a systematic survey of faculty attitudes about these kinds of things. That would be like the next stage. Did Vietnam kind of create an anti-military bias among the faculty? We got reports from ROTC students about what some professors said, et cetera.
Sure.
You're going to find that anywhere. My overall impression of UW-Madison is that faculty are pretty tolerant of it. And for some of them, it's sort of a strange thing. But I don't think there's that much overt hostility toward the military and ROTC on this campus, at least not as much as there used to be.
Do you have a sense of, speaking of West Point and Annapolis and places that are purely military
right.
in their training of officers, do you have a sense of how connected or disconnected they are from these very issues that you've talked about, as like the cost
right.
of going into a military operation and the effect of it on people?
Yeah, no, we haven't looked into that. I can't really mm-hmm. answer that. I do know that West Point is concerned about the gap problem with universities. And someone who was teaching there for a while told me that they have a major project at West Point to try to bridge the gap, and that this book, he thought that they wrote it because it addressed those very same concerns. So they are concerned about that issue. Some of the people we interviewed in the military did represent the, sort of the Eisenhower line of thinking, that Eisenhower, on one hand, he said that a country that doesn't have appropriate military might and posture is asking for war because,
yes.
A strong military can deter war. Eisenhower also said that, as being a former soldier, we know the cost of war, and that soldiers are often reluctant to go into war for that very reason. They know what it means. And so I mentioned earlier that sometimes members of Congress that don't know these things, haven't mm-hmm. been exposed to the military, they're more gung-ho to go to war. And we've ran into numerous military comments in that regard, that they exposing people more to these issues would give them a more realistic understanding of, A, the need to go to war, and also the cost of going to war, so they can make a more responsible decision.
We're going to look at the military after 9/11 and also the effect of the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Donald Downs. We're talking about ROTC, the Reserve Officer Training Corps, relationship to universities historically and in recent years also, and an added element to the mix of late since the Clinton administration or a little before is Don't Ask, Don't Tell. How does that play into the whole story?
Yeah, well, it's been crucial. The original opposition to ROTC, which led to its being effectively banned on many campuses, was, the academic thing I talked about, which tended to be the one that they talked about publicly because it was less embarrassing. The second, of course, was concerns about the war in Vietnam and anti-military thinking attached to that. And that sort of anti-military or highly suspicion of the military was the major force preserving the kind of alienation that we've been talking about. Up through the 1970s, ROTC sort of inched back in the Ivy League in the 70s and allowed it to be like a club or something, but they wouldn't allow real programs. But then, as the gay rights movement became a more prominent public thing, and in the late 1960s, I mean, it had been percolating for a long time before that. I've read some material on the gay rights movement, and it didn't just start in the late 60s in New York City. It started way before that. But that's when it really became prominent. And ran into a document in a student paper at Harvard where opposition to the military's position on homosexuality was raised as a reason for not bringing ROTC back. And, of course, by the late 1980s, it had become much more prominent. Also, universities after Brown versus Board of Education in 1954 started what Alan Silver at Columbia calls a civil rights paradigm. Universities became very much more committed to diversity, civil rights, et cetera. It was a defining thing for universities, or a defining thing, one of the most defining things. And as gay rights became part of that paradigm, the military's posture toward gays obviously became an issue. And so sometime between the later 80s, at the time, you know, Reagan had been president for 8 years, the military started coming back in terms of public esteem. A, they got their act together more. They started getting rid of the people that took the drugs. You know, Vietnam really hit them with a hard blow. Discipline was down. Respect was down. Drug taking was up. Things like that.
Morale was down.
Mm-hmm. Morale was down. That's the right way of putting it. And the military made a concerted effort to get its act together. And it did. And then the country sort of kind of moved away from the Vietnam thinking. So the military's esteem, public opinion of the military kept going up and up and up. And right now it's like number one or number two. Every year they have a survey about public esteem for institutions. So that helped. But at the same time, you had the rise of the civil rights paradigm and the rise of the gay rights movement, which were especially important for universities. So the new opposition to ROTC became the military's anti-gay position.
Did it have an anti-gay position, or did they just not – they just didn't want to know?
Well, Don't Ask, Don't Tell was passed in 1993, Clinton's first year in office. Right. Before that, and we talk about that in the book, it was still – homosexuals were not allowed to serve.
They were not. And if they were discovered, they'd get, what, a dishonorable discharge or discharge for the benefit of the service, something
right,
like that.
Right. So once Don't Ask, Don't Tell came in, and that was also because, you know, Clinton had raised expectations. And with that so-called compromise, gays were even more concerned about their exclusion. It became more and more difficult to argue for ROTC on campuses, and, you know, completely understandably so. And then with 9/11, which was another kind of turning point, more and more students started thinking, well, gee, you know, we need to start taking our military more seriously. The United States has been under attack by this international force. And Columbia, of all places, you had a student movement of people across the political spectrum that started saying, we need to think about bringing ROTC back.
Well, Columbia was in New York, after
yes,
all.
Yes, at the other end of that island, you bet. And I interviewed a number of students that were involved in that movement. And so you had a politics that was on a collision course between growing pro-military sentiment, or at least, you know, respect for the military sentiment, and entrenched concern about discrimination. And some people argued, well, given a cost-benefit analysis of sorts, we should still bring ROTC back despite this, even though we should still fight to get rid of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. That didn't happen at places like Columbia because of their commitment to their anti-discrimination principles. So it wasn't until the lifting of Don't Ask, Don't Tell that the road was really clear. That left the only opposition being the remnants of the previous anti-military positions, which were still there, but they weren't as prominent as they were before.
And was that 2010?
That was 2010, December 2010.
Where did
it all happened very quickly.
Where did the lifting of Don't Ask, Don't Tell leave the military vis-a-vis its attitude toward gays, though?
Yeah, well, that's still left to be examined. There was an exhaustive – I mean, the first – when Obama signed the order, it was still contingent upon a military inquiry into the effects of lifting the ban on the military. And exhaustive reports showed that – or claimed that the result – the impact would not be nearly as negative as the critics thought, and that would actually have some positive aspects.
Of lifting Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
Things like that, right. So that validated Obama's act, and now the military is open. But, you know, there are pockets of concern. I wrote a piece in the Chronicle of Higher Education about the lifting of Don't Ask, Don't Tell and the comeback. This is back in it was over a year ago in January, right after – it was before Columbia brought it back and Harvard brought it back. And some of the letters, some of the responses to that piece were still hostile. That, you know, you don't know what you're talking about. You're not in the military. I don't want to serve with these guys. But, you know, the military, you had the same kind of problem with racial issues when Truman.
Yes.
And we forget that, you know, the first major national institution to go on record as legally forcing integration was the military.
And yeah,
that was
1947, 48.
It was right after World War II. And an act of great foresight on the part of Truman, and there was resistance to that. Sex is a little different. I think it is a little more complicated. But military, you know, they're trained really well. It has one of the highest, most demanding professional conduct codes. And if the military and if career advancement, et cetera, is contingent upon learning how to deal with these things, then I think they will do so. Also, it's just like, you know, one reason the gay rights movement has gained so much more headway over the last 10 years is because more and more people come out of the closet. And people see people that are gay that, oh, my God, this person really isn't just this, you know, person that I can't relate to. So as you've had more and more exposure to gays, more tolerance has come about. And I think I hope the same thing will happen in the military. But right now, we don't know for sure what the result will be.
So if you look right now at the state of arms on the university, you know, what is the state? What if you look around the country? Where are we?
Yeah. Well, I think we've crossed a kind of a watershed line in the sense that universities that were before at one time hostile and then at best indifferent have come to a conclusion that we need to be more receptive and we need to be more duly respectful. And there are a lot of reasons for this. One is simply, I think, a kind of growing sense of shame that such a small percentage of the population is really bearing the brunt of our military responsibilities around the world. And pressure from students, et cetera. Also, this is another thing we haven't talked about, and I talk about it at some length in the book, but it's not a major theme, is the return of veterans to campus. And the second kind of GI Bill, mm-hmm. the Yellow Ribbon mm-hmm. Bill that was passed just a few years ago, Columbia, for example, suddenly had 200 or more veterans, and they were very prominent on campus. I mean, I interviewed a dean of the General Studies program, which is their liberal arts program for so-called non-traditional students, which means those are maybe a little bit older, come in a year or two later, have already done something in life. And he's a homosexual himself. He's a gay guy himself, against bringing ROTC back until Don't Ask, Don't Tell was lifted. And then he was totally in favor of it. And he talked about the positive influence of the veterans on the campus, the kind of experience they've showed other students, a kind of different way of thinking that added to the diversity of the campus. And he compared them to, he thought it was a rather interesting comparison, but to ballet dancers. Professional okay. dancers that bring to campus a definite kind of skill that's based on a lot of discipline and training. And he said the military does that too in its own kind of way. And so it broadens the intellectual and experiential horizons of the campus, which is really the major theme of our book when all is said and done, that kind of exposure can enhance the civic and liberal education of students by broadening their intellectual horizons.
Well, and bring them back into, say, the business world, for example, where people with military experience have that sense of command and organization.
Right. Absolutely. And you see that in the commercials on TV right now about, why you should hire a vet. So what all these things sort of represented was a kind of reintegration of the military back into the sphere of the university in a way which it hadn't been the case for quite a while. And it really boils down to a kind of appropriate mutual respect that started happening after 9/11 and really picked up during the very writing of this book. I mean, like I say in there, there are points in the book when, we started writing it, this problem, I think, the movement hadn't really gained as much momentum as it did during the writing of the book. So that's, I think, what's sort of happened. And we're going to be feeling our way with each other in terms of the military and the university and finding what that appropriate line will be. Universities are so, well-developed as institutions. I don't think they're going to allow themselves to be taken over by the military or anything like that. And they shouldn't.
Most of the time that we've had you on University Air, it's been about the First Amendment, freedom of speech. How do you see an overlap between the work you've done in that area and this book on arms in the university?
Yeah. The book really flows out of that because a central theme of free speech is sort of tolerance or due tolerance. I mean, there's certain things you shouldn't tolerate in this world, right? But, due tolerance and diversity of viewpoints. Free speech is an end to the idea is that we're going to have a wide variety of ideas and the clash of ideas together. And we talk a lot about productive friction. The university is different from the military, and that can be a good thing to a certain extent because of their very difference. It's not a reason to keep them out. It's a reason to welcome them in an appropriate basis. So it can expand the intellectual horizon of the university and the students, open its mind to forms of experience and ways of thinking which are somewhat different from the way the university usually looks at. So, and that's what free speech is supposed to be about. So they're very much linked.
Is there anything equivalent to the presence of the military on the campus if you're looking at a comparable situation?
Yeah. Well, in some ways we argue no, that it is sort of, you know, sui generis, that it's a distinctive kind of thing because of what they do. You know, they deal in the end with war and with life and death in a way which other institutions don't. But in other ways, which I think actually makes it a more profound kind of contribution, but in other ways, it's sort of similar. University has really expanded with the Obama administration has just issued this report, Crucible. I forget the whole title, but it's about the problem of civic engagement in civic education, the crisis of it, that young people don't know enough about political institutions and about, you know, it's the bowling alone kind of syndrome, that we're not engaged enough with our society. It's a controversial report for a lot of reasons I won't get into right now, but the theme is that it's appropriate for universities to encourage students to be more involved with things going on out there in the world. And we give now credit for internships, you know, over in the Capitol, a variety of private associations and businesses, et cetera. So we've moved to a lot of more practical things the university does with students than just simply educate them in the classroom. And I think this is consistent with that, having this kind of professional training on the campus and exposure of students to that. So it's similar to, you know, the university becoming a little more concerned about careers and practical experience in the real world. At the same time, it's also different because it is a kind of a special kind of thing that they do that no other institution does.
But there will be still presumably some government money backing these ROTC programs.
Right. But I think you're going to see maybe less.
Really?
This is part of the defense budget cuts that we're talking about. I was speaking to someone who has been talking to a lot of our ROTC commanders recently. He writes for American Foreign Legion magazine or something. And he said that our ROTC enrollments are the last year, and this is something I haven't kept up with, are down. And we were trying to speculate why. And he said he kept asking people in the military and the cadet commands, why is this? And they just can't tell him or they won't tell him. But we surmise that it might be because of the budget problems. And, you know, there's the grapevine now with social media, et cetera. If you go to ROTC, will there be funding for your commission down the line? Or are they going to be cutting back in officers and things like that? So that all could be affected by this. You look at the history of ROTC and recruitment, there's all sorts of factors go into it. The draft actually increased ROTC enrollment during Vietnam because my brother-in-law was an example of that.
Better to go into ROTC than to something less desirable.
Gives you more control over your fate. Though if you get out of ROTC and you become a second lieutenant, you're out there leading these guys in battle.
Yeah.
But I guess a lot of people thought, it would postpone it. Maybe the war will be over in 4 years. And others thought that, you know, it gave them a better position coming out and more control over their fate.
Well, the military does still, seems to me, have the cutting edge when it comes to technology, though. And if you want to learn about any number of technologies, communication technology, all kinds of others, the military has the budget. They have the leading edge there.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And an ROTC could be a way into that.
Right, right. So there are a lot of scholarships. We interviewed ROTC students, asked them many questions, but one was, you know, why are you doing this? And service was always the number one thing. And that's another reason I think it's good to have them on campus. It's a duty-based service mentality that is not just rights-based. But in addition to that, a lot of them said, well, yeah, it's the money, it's the scholarship, it's the career, it's the excitement, you know, maybe going out there and seeing the world and being engaged in these things.
It's not just a job, it's an adventure.
Yeah, right. Well, there you go. It's cliche, but for some of these guys, that's how they think. And for some of them, I think it is true. So the variety of motives, and that's always been an issue, concern about the all-volunteer force is that it sort of replaced a sense of duty with a sense of economics, that it's a profession and here's the economic benefits of it.
Which is a dangerous thing. Is it because then you're talking about, well, in the most extreme case, mercenaries.
Right, right. So that's, you know, we've had that tension to deal with, but based on our interviews and people I've spoken to, the sense of duty is still the number one thing. because it is a big sacrifice, and it's not like it's all that much money you get.
That's right.
It's not like being an investment banker.
Our guest has been Donald Downs. His new book is called Arms and the University, Military Presence and the Civic Education of Non-Military Students. Thanks for being our guest.
No, thank you, Emily. Thank you, Norman.
I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.